Part 7, Chapter 7. It was a startling sight. The grandeur of the scene in this thin, cold air made one feel small. Out of a river, a thin silver thread in the depths far below reared a reddish, massive wall of rock rising sheer and raw. Narrowly across from it was its echoing face. Down through the eons, the river, finding a softer strata between the two faces, had gnawed its turbulent way to make at last this gigantic knife slice in the all but impregnable stone. 1,000 feet deep, 100 yards wide, the enormous wound gaped. All around it rose majestic peaks, hiding it from the world. The sparkling white line of quartz, many feet thick, marked it with a brief diagonal line, and in that quartz, embedded and pure, gold shone and beckoned. It had, in its reality, a much greater impact than any photograph. It was like a jewel band set upon the wrinkled skin of a hag. One could see far below where a portion of the cliff face had fallen. The fragments lay like crashed pebbles in the depths. The river had eaten too deep under the cliff, and an earthquake had shaken a slice of the face loose. Snow had not fallen yet, for the year was dry, and there was nothing to impede the view. Johnny dropped the plane lower, and then the wind hit them. Funneled up the long gorge, compressed and screaming to get free, the turbulent current tore at the cliff. With fingers racing across the overlarge keys of the console, Johnny fought to keep the light personnel plane in position. It was not a dazzling load at that moment. It was a brutal, elemental wall that could crush them if they touched it. Johnny leaped the plane 1,000 feet up, clear of the updrafts, and steadied it. He turned to one of the Scots, the one who looked like him and who had spoken of burns. His name was Dunaldine McSwanson.
Can you handle this plane?
Dunaldine came forward. Robert the Fox went to a rear seat, and Dunaldine strapped himself into the co-pilot seat. In these teleportation drives, there were a number of corrections that had to be constantly watched. Some were built into the computers. Some were pre-programmed for any flight. Space itself was absolute and motionless, having no time, energy, or mass of its own. But to stay in one place relative to the mass around one, it was necessary to parallel the track of such mass. The world turned daily, and that was a near 1,000-mile-an-hour correction. Earth orbited the sun, and that required second-to-second correction. The solar system was precessing, and even if the correction was minute, it had to be compensated for. The whole solar system was en route to somewhere else at a blinding speed. The universe itself was twisting in relation to other universes. These factors and others made control of the ship a dicey business in normal times. Down there in that canyon, it was a nightmare. The irregular external buffetings of the wind upset the inertia of the motor housing and made instant shifts of coordination continual. Dunaldine had been schooled and trained in all this, but he had seen Johnny's fingers flying over that console and knew it was no routine flight. In the first place, the cyclo keys allowed for wide talons and wider paws, and it required a snapping tension in the wrists to compensate for these spacings with human hands. Dunaldine looked down at the canyon top.
"It is no room in the gloaming,"
he said,
"but I can try."
He started down. Johnny unwrapped his seatbelt and had them pass a small contrivance called a core gun to him. By firing a small rotating borer, the gun would take a 1-inch diameter chunk out of a rock face, the length of the core varying by how long one let the borer stay there before hauling it back on a line. With it, one obtained a cylindrical sample of a vein or rock.
"Start taking pictures!"
he yelled at the rest of them. They had 3 picto-recorders aboard, an instrument that measured depth below surfaces, and one that measured densities while drawing a pattern. The instruments were light cyclo prospecting tools, but being cyclo, they required a lot of muscle. The Scots took the equipment and began individually operating through the slots in the side of the fuselage. Johnny lowered his own port and readied the core gun.
Take us in as close to the vein as you can get without risking us.
Aye,
said Dunaldine.
There's the rub. Ready? Down we go.
They shot back into the chasm. Johnny could hear Dunaldine's fingers on the console keys. They sounded like a miniature of that Thompson. Then the sound was blotted out by the shrieking howl of the canyon wind. They swerved. The wall came within inches and swept back to yards. It danced up and down. The scream of the motors began to match the wind as they raced to correct positions. Johnny forced himself to concentrate. He wanted a core on the first shot, for it took time to rewind. The sparkling load danced and leaped in his sights. He pressed the trigger. With a bark and sizzle of paying out line, the corer hit the load. Dead on. He triggered the rotator. The line whipped up and down in the wind. The plane suddenly slid sideways in a sickening swoop and almost hit the opposite wall. The core came out and dangled below the ship. Johnny reeled the looping, twisting line in.
Take her up!
He shouted. Dunaldine vaulted the ship up 2,000 feet to quieter air. He sat there, limp, his arms and wrists aching, sweat heavy on his forehead.
Oh, man! 'Tis like dancing with the devil's wife!
He panted, relapsing to dialect.
Did you get your readings and pictures?
Johnny called over his shoulder. The instrument men had gotten their depths and densities, but those operating the picto recorders, struck by the awesome scene and seeing much more of it to take, said no. They wanted another crack at it.
I'll take her,
said Johnny.
The devil's wife,
said Dunaldine.
Nah, MacTyler, I have a feeling I'll be dancing this dance again some other day. I'll keep her, thank you.
He yelled back over his shoulder.
What do you want?
They wanted the slide debris at the canyon bottom.
I hope you all made your peace with the parson before we left. Here we go!
They plummeted to the bottom of the gorge and made a pass. The boiling white froth of the river fanged at the fallen fragments. They were mainly underwater. The plane fought back up the narrow gorge slowly so the picture takers could track it on both sides. Dunaldine's hands were a blur on the controls. The bucking ship screamed as its motors over-revved.
Something's getting hot,
called Robert the Fox. And it had become warm in the cabin, despite the altitude. It was the motor housings, overworked in compensating for the lunging and changing inertia of the ship. They drew opposite the top of the cliff. Johnny looked at it while the picto recorders were busy. There was no flat surface there where one could set down a ship. There was no space where one could operate a lowered drilling platform. It was all pinnacles and clefts. Johnny saw something else and called for vertical shots down the cliff face. The cliff was not vertical. It fell away inward. Anything lowered from above would hang 15 to 20 feet away from the face of the cliff. How could one hope to rig or net? They went directly above it, and Johnny saw something else.
Shoot more verticals of that top!
He called. Yes, he saw it plainly now. There was a crack inset about 30 feet from the top edge of the cliff, parallel to it. Another such crack had caused the fall of rock that bared the load, but here was a second one, just waiting for another earthquake. The whole load would pitch into the gorge. They went up 2,000 feet, and the picto recorder operators had to be content with general scenery. It was impressive enough in its gigantic beauty.
By your leave, MacTyler. If it's home we're going now, I'll exchange with Thor.
Johnny nodded. And a near duplicate of him, who was nicknamed Thor due to his Swedish background, slid over the seat top, matched his motions to Dunaldine's, and took over. Dunaldine dragged himself back to the rear.
It's a real bit fast for the Piper. Are we going to have to operate in that?
The core in Johnny's hand was part white quartz and part gold. It was a very pretty thing. This was a lure that had wooed Turl, that had given them their chance. He wondered how many lives it would take.
Head for home,
he told Thor. They were very quiet on the way back.